Welcome to another episode of Million Dollar Stories, where we get to interview authors from all over the world. You know, I love talking to authors because they have the courage to take their thoughts and their stories, put it down in a book, and share it with the many, ultimately changing their legacy and destiny in the process. And if you're an entrepreneur out there, I recommend you write a book. If you need help, check out dreamstarterspublishing.com. And if you already have a book that's already done, check out bookmarketingcrm.com. You can use the book to generate leads and grow that business of yours. Anyways, if you guys are out there and maybe you're thinking about how to develop yourself so you can get that job or establish that career, or maybe you're thinking of what could make my team better? Maybe there's some stuff you can learn in this podcast that you can relay to them. The book that we're discussing is called The Unspoken Truths for Career Success, Navigating Pay, Promotions, and Power at Work. And we have the author with us today, Tessa White. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
Well, let's start off with the genesis of this book here. It looks like there's a quote regarding Stephen Covey that says, a terrific read for the new generations rising in the workforce and for their leaders. Unbelievable sign-off from Stephen Covey. So what made you want to write this book in the first place? And if you can give a quick little background on where you come from and how you got here, that'd be helpful too.
Sure. Well, I wrote the book that I wish I'd had in my career because I was a single parent, three kids trying to raise children and figure out how to navigate my own career. And then being in HR, I realized that there really are patterns. After you see thousands of people's careers rise and fall, you realize there are certain things people do to hurt them and there's certain things they can do to help them. So I wrote that book. And I know Stephen because my first job, my first career job out of college was working for his father, Stephen R. Covey. And that was one of the most incredible experiences of my life. And the people, we were all about 25 years old. And all of the people that worked there, we've stayed in great contact with each other through the years. And every person that worked with Stephen has become just wildly successful. You know, his principles really did shape me.
I get to interview many entrepreneurs, hundreds actually I've interviewed, maybe thousands at this point. So a lot of people bring that book up as a staple to their life. So, I mean, think about the legacy you leave behind by writing that book. And you said something there pretty special. You wrote this book to your former self almost. And I think that I've realized that amongst every entrepreneur, they usually complete something that they're so proud of. They had an incredible journey and it's their moral obligation to give back to who they used to be, if you will, right?
Yeah. I mean, really, you think about, I've been hired. I've been fired. I've gotten the dream job. I've not gotten the dream job. I've gotten screwed. I've done all the things that I write about in my book. Personally, I've experienced that journey in addition to seeing so many other people go through it. So yeah, let's make it easier for those coming behind. They've got enough stacked against them to begin with, you know, our Gen Z crowd. Let's help people get ahead and learn some of those secrets.
Nice. And so I'm looking at your book. I'm looking at the outline. There's a cool way of spinning it. You talk about the lies of the performance, lies about power. But before we get to that, you start off with something's got to give. Okay. What does that mean?
Well, it's about this pressure cooker that we're under. Basically, I'm seeing, a doctor friend of ours just say, I can't handle it anymore. I can't handle what the workplace is like, even for a doctor who we think hasn't made. And he ended up working at Amazon for a while. And for my own journey, I ended up, we had a daughter with mental health issues and we knew that suicide attempt was imminent. And that journey and of mental health and somebody in my family needing help, plus this just, I say the rat race is getting rattier, and it is. It's just really, really difficult out there for people. And so that's what something has to give between the employer and the employee, I think. And no longer does the employer hold all the cards. I'm trying to teach people that, in fact, they have more power than they think they have to create an experience that can be positive for them in the workplace.
So what do you attribute that to? I'm seeing the same thing. I think many people are, and maybe just come a more aware. I have self-awareness now that I've gone through this entrepreneurial journey, but also because I could see it from both sides. I was the employee. Sure. I was the janitor. I was the landscaper. I was doing all this, the salesman, the corporate guy. And now that I see it, I guess I see a lot of people who don't know where they want to go. Also, we have all these bells and whistles, all the tools, all the technology, yet it seems like we do not have any more control over our lives, leading to ultimately, like you said, mental health issues, depression, and then there's no way out, which most likely people will distract themselves, whether it's with drugs or with alcohol. And it seems like it's a cycle that once it starts, it's very difficult to get out of. So what do you attribute that to?
Well, I have a theory. It's not scientifically proven theory, but I do a lot of research on the different generations and how we think. You know, I'm a classic Gen X, but you get a young millennial and you get a Gen Z, and they've grown up in a swipe right, swipe left world. And they haven't also, because of their native digital people, they haven't learned how to have conflict in the workplace. That's just a theme that I've seen throughout. And so if you combine those two things, kind of a more short-term thinking, a swipe right, swipe left, and this idea that I don't know how to have conflict, they would rather leave the workforce and then address some of the issues that exist. I asked this to my followers. 94% of them said, I will leave before I will write the script for my employer. So that's kind of how they see it. And I think that's really interesting, because in a relationship, you can't just say, hey, I hope my partner figures it out, or I'm going to leave. And so part of what I do, the theme throughout the whole book, is how do you communicate in a way you can be heard and not put your job at risk, but actually have a say? Because statistics say those that speak up more have higher job satisfaction, period.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you think it's because we're being taught at a very young age to avoid conflict, or having the groupthink mentality instilled at us because of school system or because of culture? And maybe the individual never has backbone, like you said, to maybe articulate their true beliefs, and they're afraid of the outcome. Therefore, they're willing to just run rather than fight, if that makes sense. So do you think it's just a part of the society becoming softer and softer as we go through these generations?
Well, I hate the, I don't like to say it's softer, because I think there's so many strengths the generation has. I mean, this is the generation that's going to lead us into balance again in the workplace, which I love. So I wouldn't say it's softer, but I would say it's, we have to be more careful the way we treat each other. It's more of a humane leadership, you know, is kind of ruling the day instead of just human capital, this you're a widget. So I love that. But I do think that because they don't know how to have conflict very well for lots of reasons, then I think it's easier to think I'm going to leave than stay. In fact, a lot of thought leaders around jobs will say the average number of jobs a Gen Z will have is 30 plus in their lifetime, which totally blows me away, because in my generation, we stayed at jobs for about 8 years. So you think about 30 jobs in a lifetime. People are moving around much more rapidly, leaving and trying to, I call it chasing the green zone. And the faster you can learn that if you can stay through a few red zones, what it can do for your career and what it can do for you to learn how to solve problems and be more innovative around solutioning when hard things hit, it really is worth a lot on your resume, $10,000 to $20,000 to stay through a red zone.
Wow. Yeah. I'm glad you bring that up, that people are treating it very temporarily rather than trying to stick it out. And I think that's just a part of society, right? Everybody's leasing their cars, renting where they live. Yeah, I mean, I rent where I live, so it's not a bad thing, but I don't think it is. So people are looking at things, you know, subscriptions. Everything is really just leased, right? And so when it comes to technology, I could work from home, I can work anywhere. So there are more options, leaving me with this decision that I don't need to put up with this. I can go somewhere else right away. And so what that does do, and I believe in this 100%, it keeps putting you back to zero, right? Even though it might be a new pathway and it might be exciting, the longer you stay on a certain pathway, the chances of making more money as you go through that pathway increase, right? So you develop, you opportunities start to rise, and you start to become known for something in that area. So people who bounce around, it may seem temporarily exciting and beneficial, but it might hurt them pay-wise. So is that what you're noticing too, that that's the common root cause, that people jump from ship to ship and they go back to the ground zero basically?
They do. Although what the belief is I'm going to make more money when I jump, and you will. You'll make more money if you jump, but over time, three or four jumps in a row that are really short term will actually have a cumulative effect that is really negative on your resume. So while I totally understand that's one of the primary ways to get a raise, what people are missing is that when you learn these skill sets, particularly if you play across laterally, all these like operations and HR and finance, and you learn these different worlds, that is worth a tremendous amount on your resume. It's worth a lot, not today, but it's worth a lot in your next job. And so if we can think more long-term, less short-term, there are great advantages to staying. And in fact, those people that stay through a red zone in their company where it just feels like chaos, so many people leave that it gives you more opportunity, and you often get really big increases and big opportunities to learn new things that you can then take to the next job. So it's a delayed benefit, but it is a big benefit.
Man, it makes me think of an investor that I interviewed not too long ago. He says, in order to be successful, all you have to do is invest like a dead man. And I was like, what does that mean? And he goes, we realized that, and he managed the top 1% net worth, like 250 richest families in the United States. And he said, the people who just put their money in and then just invest and never change anything actually make way more money than those who are kind of jumping around from stock to stock and trying to be smarter than the market. And I find it very relatable to what you just said, that sometimes when you stay the course, even in those downturns, you end up making more money. So I find that fascinating. Anyways, you have the problem with people. Can we jump to that chapter? What is that all about?
Well, everybody thinks that it's the company sucks, the manager sucks, but they don't suck. That's what everybody thinks. You know, I don't suck. I'm the only one in this whole equation that doesn't. And I'm just here to tell people they suck too. And it really goes down to, you know, we get mad at companies or managers because we don't feel like they're transparent, or our manager's trying to use us. But the same is true for us. We're trying to work as little as we can to get as much money as we can. Just like the company's trying to work us as hard as they can and pay us as less as they can. We both are doing the same thing. And people are just as bad at communication as managers are, even though we love to say managers are the worst. And sometimes they are. But people are also not very forthright in talking about what they need, what they want, and what they expect out of a company. And that's why I say people are as much of a problem as this entity that we love to hate, the company.
So accountability should be at the forefront, right? It's what can I fix about myself rather than what can I fix about the company? Because there's a whole hell of a lot more you can do about yourself than the company. Am I right?
That's right. Well, take pay. That's the number one complaint people have, is I'm getting worked to the bone and I'm not getting pay. You know, somebody leaves the company and I absorb their work and the company gives me a dry promotion and no pay. Well, you know, my response is, have you talked with the company about your expectation? Have you brought it up? And have you talked about it and what it would take to get you the pay increase? Because most people are afraid to, they either go one way or the other. They go silent and don't bring it up and get resentful, and quiet leads to quit every single time. Or they go the other extreme and get really angry and they just go scorched earth. And neither of those approaches work. So I'm just a big believer that you have to have conversations like you would with a partner, set expectations of what you want. When the company doesn't meet your expectation, and you actually get a lot more. The people that learn how to do that, I mean, I have thousands and thousands of case studies in my head. Those are the people that make more money. They're the people that are happier.
Makes me think of the quote, do more than what you're paid for, and soon you'll be paid for more than what you do. Do you believe in that too?
Sometimes, but sometimes not. Sometimes I think a number one rule of a company is it will take as much as you're willing to give. And so that doesn't help people who are quiet. That doesn't help people who just keep taking it on. And although I do think we love to reward people who do really good things for us, sometimes companies take advantage as well, and they'll continue to give people more and more until that person crumbles under the weight of it. So it's only true to a point.
Now, the laws of physics, I think, apply very well to entrepreneurship, and everybody has understood there's always a reaction to every action, right? And right. I think that one thing that I focus on in business is, all right, if I want a certain reaction, I need to first focus on the input, the action part. And mm-hmm. So I'm always thinking about what can I put into it, and therefore that will produce the end result. I think a lot of people are focusing on the more pay, you know, the free time, the excitement in the work, but they forget about the action aspect.
That's
right.
Have you
noticed the same characteristics that people are always looking for the end result, but forgetting about the one major piece, the first ball has to hit, right?
Yeah, results. I mean, if you really look at what you're paid for, it's results and making a difference. That's what the company notices. And A lot of people will make the mistake of thinking, I just need to follow my job description better, which is just a pile of crock, because that job description was written by somebody in HR right before they went home from work and they're trying to post it. Doesn't mean anything. Your real job is to figure out what the real job is from the job on the job, from the words on the job description. And if you can't get results, and secondly, if you can't talk about what those results are and measure those results, it might as well not have happened. People who play in the gap and help a company between what they want to be versus what they actually are, which is usually pretty broken. If you can't play in that gap, it's going to be harder to get promotions. Just working hard is not enough. You got to work smart. You got to know what the real needs are and go after, I call it the gold vein. You got to go after the gold vein in the company.
Wow. It's a good point. Yeah. Just sticking to your job description isn't enough. It's going out there and really adding value. And I think if there's a great manager or a great leader at the helm, they notice it and therefore they reward those people. And that's what they're always looking for. Right. So it's awesome. Tell me about Lies About Power. I thought of the 48 laws of power the moment I read that. So what is this chapter about?
Well, basically, a lot of people think that if you have the corner office or the title, that that's really that's how you get power in a company. And I've seen a lot of people in corner offices that end up not doing well and getting laid off or fired. It really isn't the title or the corner office. What gives you power in an organization is having knowledge that is having this knowledge. Knowledge and power are correlated. If you know stuff that somebody else doesn't know, that's power. So everybody, regardless of their title, secretary on up, really needs to be able to study their industry, see where the problems are, create their own dashboard so that they can measure it, and give data to their leaders, because senior leaders sometimes get stuck in this world where they see the same data over and over. And yet we know like 80% of the data in a company is dark data. It's hidden. It's not even in a report. And when you can start to measure and change the, you know, move the needle on the things that are really broken within your sphere of influence, that's how you get power in an organization. And so you've got to talk the language of business, which is numbers. If you can't do that, it's just not helpful, because that's what they respond to. That's what they hear, is the language of numbers. Did I create a greater efficiency? Is the customer happier? Did I make more money? Did I remove steps from a process? Those are the kinds of things you have to focus on.
Now, the next one here about the corner office, it makes me think of when I graduated from Duquesne University. I wanted an office job. I wanted to wear a suit. I wanted to be, you know, looked upon with admiration because I was successful. Well, then I got an office job and I hated it with a passion. And yeah, it was almost like, oh, you mean to tell me that I worked for this? This is not who I am, right? Shook me to the core. And that's whenever I realized, all right, I'm an entrepreneur. I'm more of a street fighter. I like to be out there doing some stuff that is like, felt like I was in the wilderness. And it was that self-awareness check that I needed. But maybe that's what you're talking about in this chapter, where maybe some of the things you're pursuing, you really don't want. Or when you get it, you're like, is this it? So tell me about number six, chapter six.
Well, we go on autopilot. What happens in a company is we go in, we figure out, we see problems, and we go home and say, this company's so messed up. And then about 3-4 months later, we just go with the flow. You know, it's just like you get used to it rather than changing it. But I tell a story about a guy I called Cubicle Guy. This guy seriously lived in a cubicle. I don't think he made more than 50 grand at the time. And one day I walked past and he's sitting in the executives, in the senior executives room, and he's drawing on a whiteboard while the executives are just intently staring at this whiteboard. And I'm like, what is this guy doing? Then I watched him in a lunchroom and he was like talking with other departments. And then one day you fast forward and he's in the CEO's office showing him something on his computer. And the CEO is just like so locked in. This guy actually ended up getting promoted over and over in the company and rising very quickly. And it's because he studied the industry, he studied the data, he listened to the quarterly reports, and he had a point of view about how to solve some problems, or wow, he saw it a little differently. And the guy got promotion after promotion and ended up rolling out this innovation program whereby all the employees could submit ideas on how the company could do better, bring in more revenue, save more money. And that's what I'm talking about with power. The guy just he studied, he's curated knowledge, and then he made something out of it. He saw it, he solved it, he talked about it. And most people go, yeah, I know that was a problem. Sure, that's a problem, but they shrug their shoulders and wait for somebody else to solve it. And that's not going to get you a seat at the table.
Wow. Is that also the lies about the corner office, that you don't need to be there to actually make a difference? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I'm saying you see it, you solve it. I mean, that's available to everybody. See a problem, solve a problem, and stop waiting for somebody else to fix it. Because when I go into companies, they hire me to come in and say what's broken. All I do is visit with, you pick any random group of employees. I'll sit and talk with them privately, and I'll come out and give this big report and say, here's some things you need to pay attention to. And they're like, oh my gosh, she's reading the mind. How did she know so much? The people know. The people always know what's going on in a company. It's just a lot of people just sit and let it happen and just kind of allow the problems to be there rather than actually doing anything about it or deciding to speak up and talk about it or make a run at solving it.
Another thing I've learned as I build this company, people really respond to being given responsibility over others, right? All right. So here, I'm going to give you the ability to either hire people or manage them. And I've seen an acceleration of their development once they become a manager. It's fascinating to me. So I just love seeing someone that I believe in, giving them more responsibility and see how they respond afterwards. Is that part of this playbook, almost asking for more responsibility, you know, constantly maybe seeking it, and therefore once you give it, you now see it from both sides, not just being an employee but being a manager, and absolutely, what comes from that? So can you explain what's happening there, I guess?
Yeah, you know, IBM had this right about 20 years ago. They talked about owning your own popcorn stand, and they would try and teach high potential people to kind of own their own piece of IBM and run it like it was their own business. And I believe that people should, if they're in a traditional corporate role, they should definitely ask for their own top performer plan. And they don't have to say, give me a top performer plan, but they need to ask for, I need exposure to the senior people in the organization. I want to listen in on meetings. I want to see how decisions are made. I want to see what we look at. They need to have opportunities to run cross-functional groups and see how that works. So people need to be able to have more responsibility and see the world through the eyes of a more senior person in order for them to be better leaders. And I also think there's tremendous value in people running their own business. I think that when people run their own business, suddenly it's like, boom, the lights go on and they're like, wow, this is harder than I thought. You can't just give people something to do and then it just magically all comes together and happens. It's really hard to run a business and pull a profit, which is what businesses do. They have to make a profit to be viable. So I love people getting the opportunity to run their own mini popcorn stand or run their own business. And then I think it makes them a better employee if corporate America is what they want. And if they want to go the other direction, get a top performer plan put in place for yourself. There's a whole chapter on it in the book on what you ask for and how you ask for it. And then go the other direction and start your own business. And you'd be surprised how that is complementary and helps you.
Yeah, it's wild to see, you know, people, the moment they adopt this phrase in my company is think like an entrepreneur. And when you do that, you can basically see chaos, and wherever there's chaos, there's opportunity. But if you think like an entrepreneur and you take ownership of your division or that section that you're responsible for, you start to see it from, you know, the manager down to the employee. And then the eyes would just open up. Oh, wait a second. This is what I'm looking for in the people that work with me or for me. Uh-huh. If I want to be noticed and to get opportunities, I just need to take those characteristics that I'm looking for and then really embody them so other people see that in me. And so it just kind of lends favor that the moment you either run your own business or you're in charge of other people, something happens in the brain where it gives you a different perspective. And I think it just sets you on the right track.
I think too that running a business, you know, you can't have a viable business without pulling a profit. And it's actually pretty hard to do. And I think that in corporate America, I think every employee should have a piece of the action. Company wins, the employee wins. And you should be able to mimic ownership or create ownership opportunities for people, because you behave differently when you're aligned to the things that your senior executives are aligned to. What I'm not in favor of is people just working harder and not getting a piece of the action. I mean, we can train employees in corporate America to actually behave like business owners if we align them to the right things. And that's a big shift that I wish were happening across corporate America. Some companies are getting it right. Other companies are still steeped in this old model of let's give all the money to the senior executives. And I just don't think that's going to be something that works in the future. And it's why so many young people are leaving the workplace and saying, I'm going to create my own destiny. I want to start my own business. And it's going to be hard. We're going to see a lot of failed businesses, but you're also going to see, if you fast forward 10 or 15 years, you're going to see some incredible, incredible businesses come to light with people who don't want to work for corporate America anymore and want to start their own thing and figure it out.
When I first read the title of this book, it made me think of all the intangibles that many people disregard. And I know that even within my own organization, I get excited if and we do a lot of Zoom calls, right? But I get excited if maybe somebody on my team buys a new light, looks a little better on camera, right? Uh-huh, dresses right. A little nicer, speaks a little bit more articulately, right? So I think all of these intangibles are disregarded because they're like, well, as long as I'm doing my job, that's all that really matters. No, there's the presentation. It's your tonality. It's your energy. All of these things are being picked up on whether you realize it or not. So how much do you discuss that stuff in your book?
You know, it's a theme in there, but it's more subtle. It really, what I talk about is you got to figure out and get aligned to what's most important. And that's going to be different from group to group, department to department. And it's never going to be the thing that is just so easy to find. You have to align and realign every single day with your manager because they change their mind and executives change their mind about what's most important. So getting aligned to what that is. And watching. There's a whole chapter on politics. Politics aren't a bad thing. You got to watch the politics of a company. And I share that there's five aspects. You got to know whether the company rewards, for instance, fast or slow, or whether they reward innovation and making mistakes or really traditional steady Eddie. I mean, there's lots of things you have to watch and clues that you would have as to what's going to get rewarded at your company and then do more of that thing. Like I worked at a company, I'd come from healthcare. Healthcare rewards traditional thinking, methodical movement, really safe decisions. And I went into this crazy company. It was about 4,000 flat-brimmed hat bros and 10 adults in the room. I mean, this was not healthcare. And I thought I was going to get fired. They said, you can't go fast enough. You got to go faster. They were writing comp plans on a napkin in 2 weeks, rolling out a comp plan. You'd never do that in healthcare. And once I made the adjustment, I did incredibly well. I was like, went from like, she's not going to work out to, all right, we got something going here. And so people have to pay really close attention to what's getting rewarded and do more of that thing. It's going to be different from company to company.
And is it basically just analyzing the core values of the company at that moment or what the leader values?
It's kind of the culture. So take a look at, you know, whether it's a company that rewards fast versus slow or innovation versus safety, or whether it's somebody that likes wild, wild west or decisions by committee. You know, there are so many, and neither of them are wrong, by the way. Sometimes it's a really smart thing to have a lot of people weighing in and buying in on a decision. I'm not saying any of them are wrong, but if I go in and I behave like Wild West and I just make changes left and right, and this is a company that makes decisions methodically by committee, I'm going to fail. So you have to read it. You have to be able to read it and make the right decision so that it fits with that company. And just take a look at the people that you think are brown nosers. They're typically not. We typically mislabel them a little bit. Watch what they do. Watch what's rewarded. And you'll be able to get a clue as to the roadmap for your own company.
Yeah. When you're talking, it makes me think of speed. I just value speed. I say it over and over. And I'm a Wild Wild West guy, right? I love shooting from the hip and that's what I value. So whenever I see somebody take 3 days to respond to an email, I'm telling you, it makes my blood boil. All right. And I've gotten way better, but to see it, and I still have to say something because they should know by now that speed is really what I value. And I think that's part of the organization. This is a small business. We're talking about 20 people maybe, right?
Right.
If you go into the Disney's and the Apples, it might be different because of how structured it has to be and how complicated things are. But wow, I think what you just said nails it. Find out what they value because that is what they will notice when it doesn't hit the spot.
And on that same vein, your manager is going to be one of, you know, three types of managers. They're GSD, get shiz done. And they're not going to value if you want to talk to them before you make every decision. They're going to hate it. They're going to say, just get it done. And then there's managers who are really collaborative and really want to be a part of the decision making because their name's on whatever you do in their department. And then there's managers that are like split the middle and they're like, give me a 3-page slide deck. Tell me what we're doing. Show me the numbers and then I'll weigh in on it. And you really have to understand, you know, which manager you have as well. These are just small little tricks that you got to pick up. Otherwise, you know, if you went into healthcare, you'd fail immediately. They would hate you, right? Because you're fast, Wild West, see a problem, solve a problem guy. And so you really do have to read your environment.
Now, when it comes to careers, we've done a few books with people who help people with their careers. And what we found out is that ground zero moments are like the greatest thing that could possibly happen to people, whether it's a firing or, you know, a layoff or something happens within the organization where they decide to leave and then they're left with nothing. This is whenever they have that self-actualization. What do I really want? Who do I want to become? Mm-hmm. And this is when you can build the life of your dreams, I think. Ground zero moments are a blessing in mm-hmm. disguise. So have you noticed that, you know, if somebody is out there looking for their dream career, how will they know, number one, they're on the right path? And number two, if something does happen, could it be really the launch pad? And have you seen it over and over again?
Well, personally, I think one thing I've seen over and over again is that your brain lies to you. Your brain is going to tell you during a red zone, which could be this ground zero moment, it's going to tell you something's gone terribly wrong. If you're in a company and let's say that, you know, they have big layoffs or, you know, the systems are breaking, you have to fix everything. You're going to say, I'm in the wrong company, wrong industry. And I will tell you that the company that I went to when I started, and it was crazy. There's two of us in HR. I was supposed to take the company, help them go public in 6 months. They didn't know how many people worked for them. They were hiring 200 people a month and there was two of us. They were opening an office every 2 weeks. I mean, it was insanity. And I think a normal person would go, crap. Red zone, I'm out. I'm in the wrong company. I'm in the wrong job. And it ended up being one of my favorite jobs ever. After the first 6 months, I cried in the bathroom every day. So our brain lies to us and tells us that because it's uncomfortable, it's wrong. And when you get laid off, your brain says it's over. You know, this was a mistake. This is a bad time in my life. When in fact, it is the actual trigger for reinvention and the trigger to be doing, to do something differently. And we should embrace it because that's how you find who you are. Like me, who would have guessed at age 55, I was going to start my own business and be an influencer at my age. But all of a sudden I have over 1 million followers. I've got a book out and I'm doing the thing that I wish I'd have done my whole life. You know, this is perfect for me. So it's never too late. You need to, when those uncomfortable red zone moments hit, understand that your brain's going to tell you some lies and stick with the discomfort for a bit and see where it takes you. Don't just try and get right back into a place of comfort, taking the next job, the first job that comes, because that's also a mistake. Speed will kill you when you get laid off and you want to take the next safe thing. Speed will kill you.
You'll make a bad decision, right? It's an emotional decision, not a long-term vision decision.
Oh, it's just like breaking up with a boyfriend that abuses you and then you run into the next relationship. You know, the therapist would say, don't do it. Give yourself time. You know, or you're going to make the same mistakes again. And the same is true when you leave, when you end a job, jumping to the next thing that feels good is often the wrong thing. You really need to understand what you value, the environment and the culture you're going to thrive in. Are you a get shiz done person? Are you Wild West? Are you not? Because just looking at a company, an article that says this is one of the best 10 best companies to work for in the United States means absolutely nothing. It may not be one of the 10 best companies for you to work for. And it may be the answer starting your own thing. I mean, I have 6 kids. 5 of them started their own business. And which is funny because I'm the job doctor, right? I teach them how to do corporate America. But starting their own business is what each of them have done. I'm thrilled to watch them take that journey. And it was the right journey for them.
Now, when you were talking, I think in the very beginning about agreeableness and disagreeableness, made me think of a Jordan Peterson quote/book, how disagreeable people make more money. And I think it's because they usually have their own opinions and ideas, and they take ownership of them. And I've read this stat that, you know, if you as an owner slash entrepreneur have an idea and you know that 80%, if you do it the right way, it's going to be a success, and you give it to someone who doesn't believe in that idea, but they have another idea. And then they say that other idea there, you probably has a 50% chance of making it, but you would rather them take the 50% chance because they will get behind it 100% rather than an idea that you know will work, but they'll only get behind it 20%, let's just say.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
And so they're disagreeable to a sense, right? Where if they have another idea, all right, you do it your way, right? I like that. And if you could back it and you could say, I'm going to do it better than you, there's more ownership of it. And I think people respond to it. I think those are the type of people who make more money. So can you tell us a little bit about what you've noticed in the corporate space? Disagreeable, most likely, takes on more responsibility, in that responsibility leading to more results equals more money. So what's happening there?
Well, Elizabeth McCune at Microsoft did a bunch of research on this. People that speak up on more than 13 issues in a given year have high 90s job satisfaction ratings. Those people who, if you just cut the number of times they speak up in half, it drops by like 35 points, your job satisfaction. So there is a connection between speaking up. But I would just say, I think there's a misinterpretation with especially younger generations. When we say being disagreeable, that doesn't mean that you have to be bitchy.
An asshole. It. Yeah. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. That is not what we're saying. It's saying if you have something that you think might help or you have a point of view, a perspective, share it. That's what we're saying, is being brave enough to share it. And that can yield the kinds of results that we're talking about. Just being disagreeable in and of itself, or being disagreeable, isn't going to get anybody anywhere.
Yeah, great point there. It's not that you want to just be combative at every turn.
Yeah.
It's speaking your mind, being honest, transparent. It's showcasing that you have backbone, that you're an expert in your area, right? Hey, I know this sounds great, but I have something that's a little bit better and I don't agree with what you're saying. And me as a leader would respond to that, or me as a client. If I have an idea with a business that I'm working with and I'm like, I think we should have to do it this way, and they stand up for themselves, I'll say, you must be somewhat of an authority in this. Therefore, I respect your ability to communicate that to me so clearly that I trust you more. And I think that's what happens in the marketplace or the workplace.
Yeah, I think what people struggle with is how to do that. And I give people three sentences that'll keep the conversation moving and going forward, because the whole goal is to assume good intent in the other person. And if you disagree on something, being able to, you could botch most of the conversation, but as long as you say, do you see it differently? Is that what you intended? If you're bringing up something negative, or is there some information missing that would help me understand? When you're addressing conflict, those three magic questions allow for conversation to continue happening and assume good intent. Most conversations that go awry, or most opinions that are shared that go in the toilet, are because inherent in the thing we said, we're assuming bad intent in the other person, like you're stupid or you don't know what you're talking about. And so partner language, the kind of language that's going to get your opinions listened to, require you to share an opinion and then be able to say, do you see it differently? And allow that conversation to still blossom and still happen, versus just assuming somebody else is dumb, you know, doesn't know their stuff.
If they pick up your book today, and the book, guys, is called The Unspoken Truths for Career Success, what is one takeaway that you want these individuals to leave with? Is there anything that you would share with them that you haven't shared on this podcast yet?
Well, I would tell them that they can have more control over their career than they think they can. If they think that going into corporate America means that they're going to be miserable forever and just at the whim of what their company wants, I would say your eyes are going to be opened. Because what I go through are these lies and truths of the workplace are 10 different areas that you can have more control over your job and your life than you think. And we go through politics, promotions, pay, all kinds of different areas that are, and I'll give you scripts even on how to confront the most typical things you're going to run up against. But you will find that if you speak up, you will create a better experience for you and a better career path for yourself.
And I'm assuming you've studied the trends of what's happening. Is there any study or stat or a fact that really blows you away of what's happening, whether people stay 18 months at a certain position before they move on, or the reason why they leave is not because of money. It's more so about, you know, they're not following their passions now than ever before.
Yeah.
Anything that really stands out?
The stat that's really, really interesting to me is if you look at the generational differences in attitude around work, and you go back to like my dad was one job, one path,
same,
pension, right? Pension. That's what I'm after. Next generation, it's maybe I'll get a house. Go to the next generation, urban comforts. Maybe I have a nice car, maybe nice, you know, go out to some nice restaurants. You go to Gen Z, who's now infiltrating workplace, they're lucky to have $200 in their pocket at any given time. And so things have moved from long-term to short-term. And I'm seeing 8 years in a job to 2 years in a job. And this short-term thinking, this swipe right, swipe left, is also hurting the new generation going in. And unless you're aware that that's actually going on, that your attention span is different, like the average attention span is 3 minutes for a work issue. That's 3 minutes is about what where we're at. Unless you understand what's happening to your brain, you're going to jump around and you're going to make assumptions and leave companies or leave positions, and it's going to hurt you in the long run.
Wow. I like that. I've not heard that when it comes to work issues, 3 minutes. I got to remember that. I got to remember that when I have these team meetings. That's great. Is there a website? You actually do have a website that's pretty easy to find. I believe it's thejobdoctor.com. Is that right?
Yeah. Jobdoctor.com. You can rent my brain. We have a mentoring community we're getting ready to launch at the end of summer. And they can also find my own podcast on Spotify and Apple, The Job Doctor is in. And they can see me work with real people through real problems and watch us evolve how to solve it, which I think is really interesting for people.
Nice. Guys, TikTok and Instagram, Job Doctor Tessa. It's easy to find. And thejobdoctor.com. The book is called The Unspoken Truths for Career Success, Navigating Pay, Promotions, and the Power at Work. Tessa, you are a true professional. You're easy to find if anybody Googles Tessa White.
Don't find me.
I really appreciate you coming on and spending a little time with us today. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you so much.
Remember, guys, a $1 million book will lead to a $1 million life. Right on.